Now, as a young man and a young doctor, John Boffa felt drawn to go out into the world and do good for people who were struggling. The world he found turned out to be inside his own country. While waiting for a visa to allow him into India to do medical work with the poor, he took a temporary position in the Northern Territory. 30 years later, he's still there. Dr. John Boffa is now the Chief Medical Officer at the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress. He's also an Adjunct Associate Professor at the National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University. Dr. John Boffa, how nice to have you with us.
That's great to be here.
And welcome to the year that made me. What are you doing right now?
Oh, look, I think we've seen the implementation of, I think, the world's most exciting leading alcohol policy reforms on the 1st of October last year, which have already made a very dramatic impact. So in the first 3 months, we've seen a 50% reduction in alcohol-related assaults from around 350 a month to about 170 a month. And also a similar reduction in domestic violence, alcohol-related domestic violence assaults cut in half. This is one of the really, really big positive developments in the Northern Territory. It's a watershed moment in how the jurisdiction is dealing with alcohol.
And you know, what's the trick? What have you done?
It's a combination of measures. So on October 1, we had the implementation of Australia's first minimum unit price on alcohol at $1.30 a standard drink. We're one of the first jurisdictions in the world to implement a minimum price on alcohol in combination with other measures. We've got police auxiliary licensing inspectors on takeaway liquor outlets, all of them in Alice Springs, and that has a big impact on the amount of takeaway that people can buy. We've got a banned drinkers register, so everyone has to show photo identification when they buy takeaway alcohol. And if you've committed a high-range drink driving offence or an alcohol-related assault, you go onto the banned drinkers register for a period of time and you can't purchase takeaway alcohol.
So what are you seeing among those who are on the banned drinkers register? That they might have had a serious driving offence, they might have had a domestic violence offence. Are they now not drinking at all, or are they simply getting around it by other means?
Look, they can drink on licence, and some do, but by definition, on licence is much more regulated, particularly when you've got the tough new measures to make sure that people aren't being served to the point of intoxication on licence. But it's difficult for them. They can't purchase takeaway, and it's an offence to provide them with takeaway alcohol. 70% of all the harm comes from takeaway alcohol. Well, we've got to evaluate it properly. It hasn't been evaluated yet, but what's clear as a package of measures, if you look at everything, the population data, very clear that we've had a big impact, at least in Alice Springs.
So you work for the Central Australian Aboriginal Congress. Do these measures, are they primarily driven towards Aboriginal Australians, or do they equally apply to those who are non-Aboriginal?
Look, all of the measures, apart from one, apply to the whole population. The one measure that is discriminatory, that doesn't apply to everyone, is the police on the outlets. When the police are on the outlets, they're only stopping people who live on alcohol-prohibited land buying takeaway alcohol. And the overwhelming majority of people in that category are Aboriginal people. So that affects Aboriginal people from remote communities, from the town camps. So that is, if you like, overtly discriminatory in its impact. Police ask everyone when they go to purchase alcohol. They're meant to ask everyone, and there's issues about whether they do. But the overwhelming impact of that has been so dramatic, it's accepted, if you like, I think, as an undeclared special measure. So under the Racial Discrimination Act, you can have special measures. This hasn't been challenged at this stage, and it hasn't been declared a special measure. So it's, if you like, it is a legal grey area. But I think it has been accepted by the majority of the community.
What kind of boy were you, John Boffa?
I came from a very good family. I lived in an upper middle class suburb in Melbourne. I had four, I'm one of five children. We had a mother who was very loving, very caring, had a great early childhood. I went to Xavier College, you know, a Jesuit school. It was a fantastic secondary school. So I had a very privileged upbringing. And you know, that was one thing the Jesuits instilled into me. You know, if you've had a privileged upbringing, I think more is expected of you in terms of giving back to the community. And that was something that was always in the back of my mind.
Tell me about Gertrude Street.
That was something when I was doing medicine, I always wanted to maintain contact, you know, on a regular basis with extremely disadvantaged people. Once I got into medicine, decided to volunteer, and I worked in a place called The Way in Gertrude Street. So one night, it was a Monday night, I'd go there, I think I started at 11 o'clock, and I'd sleep overnight till the next morning. And we used to look after about 20 to 25 men. It was all men. And these are men who were basically skid row alcoholics on the streets of Fitzroy, were allowed to live in the way that the rules were. They could drink during the day, but once they came into the house, they weren't allowed to drink, and they had to obey certain rules and respect certain things. But, you know, people were really unhealthy. So most nights someone would have a rum fit from withdrawal. There'd be very depressed people in tears. You know, it was a very great way to continue to be able to see how difficult life is for some people. You know, it was a very important part of my life at that stage. It was one of the things that made me realise that I wanted to do something else with medicine and not just stay in the big teaching hospitals.
What did it tell you about alcohol?
It told me that alcohol is incredibly damaging. It told me that liquor outlets are completely unscrupulous. Like, for instance, people used to drink methylated spirits, and then they brought in methylated spirits with poison in it. So the purple methylated spirit. So if you tried to drink it, you'd vomit. And I thought, what a great thing. That's gonna solve that problem. But outlets along Gertrude Street deliberately sold the distilled methylated spirits without the poison in it, so people could still drink it. And you'd think, why would anyone do that? But they did. So we were forever trying to get the men to realise that, okay, you're drinking, don't drink methylated spirits. You know, try and drink full-strength beer, take your time. This is harm minimisation. It's not getting people off the grog. It's about getting people to not drink really cheap grog. You know, my two uncles were publicans, and I know they ran pubs in a responsible manner. My great-grandmother was one of the first women in Victoria to own an alcohol outlet. She owned a pub in Brunswick. And, you know, she told a great story that in her time, only men were allowed in there into the public bar and buy grog in you know, I'm talking before 1920. And she realised these guys were getting drunk, and she realised their families were struggling for food for the kids. So what she did, she implemented, I think, a first price-based mechanism. She had jars under the bar with family names on it. And when the guys had got reasonably drunk, she'd start, when they gave her the cash for their alcohol, she'd keep the change. And they wouldn't realise because they already had too many drinks. And she'd put the change in the jars with the family names on it. And the next morning, the wives would come in and they'd get what money was left over.
Crafty woman.
Oh, it was a great idea. So I think that's the beginning of realising, you know, that you've got to do things to stop. People who are alcohol dependent don't regulate themselves, and you've got to have strategies in place to assist and regulate and look after children, look after families.
So 1988 is the year that made you, as you nominate it. What happened?
Yeah, look, that was the key year that changed my life around. I already realised I wanted to try something different, so I got permission to take a year off from the physician training program. I was at the Alfred Hospital in Melbourne, and I had planned to go to India, and I'd planned, you know, 9 months in advance and applied for my visa, but it didn't come through. And at that stage, there were real barriers to people with any sort of religious conviction going to work in India, because, you know, I understand now the cross-cultural concerns, the proselytism that can happen, you know, I understand that better now than I did then. So the visa was held up, and a Jesuit friend of mine was aware of this health service, Aboriginal Health Service in Tennant Creek, and he knew a woman called Chris George, who was the Aboriginal director, and she told him they hadn't had a doctor for 3 weeks and they were desperate. So I said, well, I might as well go there to start with, and that's what I did. I went to Tennant Creek, I think it was February 22, 1988.
Immediately you started making difficulties for people. Particularly some of the practices in the public bar.
Oh, well, look, it was just as a GP, you know, I quickly started to see women who'd been raped on the way home from one of the public hotels, the Tennant Creek Hotel. They'd been in a drop the top contest, taken their tops off for a $50 grog voucher. And then the view was they were fair game. So I'd seen a few women early on who'd been raped in that context, in the context of these sex shows in the public bars, and they were absolutely out of control. Like, it was a massive eye-opener for me. I'd been overseas. I'd seen Pigalle Square in Paris once, you know, I had a bit of an idea, but these strip shows, they weren't, you know, there was live sex on stage in public bars, in hotels, in Tennant Creek at that stage. And the strippers used to come to town on a Thursday, starting Thursday lunchtime, Friday, Saturday, and they'd end up with what was called strip and porn, like in the lounge bar on a Sunday. It was more of an upmarket event. You know, live sex acts, audience participation all the time. Some of the strippers would work as prostitutes. So the town was inundated from all over the Barclay, the cattlemen, the meat workers, the miners. They'd all come to Tennant. Really, it came to a head when a 15-year-old boy who'd been in the public bar, seen one of these shows, on the way home, raped his school teacher. And when that went to court, the magistrate ruled it was inadmissible, that the defence were not allowed to use the strip show in the public bar and the fact that he was there. It was seen to be inadmissible. So the health service started a campaign, which I was part of, under Neon Congress, and we eventually succeeded. There was a lot of support from women in the community. We had public meetings. We wrote to the newspapers, and it was an effective campaign. In the end, they made the voluntary code of ethics. And then it just all stopped. Once all that happened, all the extras went and people stopped coming to town. And very soon, one of the alcohol outlets closed down. The tavern closed down, still never reopened, which left...
I mean, you're talking about Tennant Creek here, but it's still a community with enormous difficulties. With watching it over that period of time, I saw you give a speech when you were named Northern Territory Australian of the Year in 2012, and you were quite optimistic at that stage about Tennant Creek. Are you still optimistic about it?
Yeah, look, I think I am optimistic about it. I think the inherent strength in the Aboriginal community in Tennant Creek is absolutely amazing. I think... And that'll never be overcome by even the most adverse social environment. The town suffered a major economic downturn and, you know, there's still enormous disadvantage there. But underneath the resilience and strength of the Wurrumbungu people and other language groups in that area, I think will prevail, and that's what makes me optimistic.
John Boffa, Northern Territory doctor and health advocate. Thanks so much for your time today. Your song is Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody, the classic from Little Things, Big Things Grow.
Gather round people, I tell you a story, an 8-year long story, power and pride, the British Lord Vestey, Vincent Lingari, were opposite men on opposite sides.
Vestey was fat with money and muscle. Beef was his business, broad was his door. Vincent was lean, spoke very little. He had no bank balance, hard dirt was his floor.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Gurindji were working, nothing but rations. Once they had gathered the wealth of the land, daily depression got tighter and tighter. Gurindji decided they must make a stand.
They picked up their swags, started off walking at Waddy Creek. They sat themselves down. Now it don't sound like much, but it sure got tongues talking back at the homestead and then in the town.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Vesty man said, I double your wages. 7 quid a week you have in your hand. Vincent said, we're not talking about wages. We're sitting right here till we get our land.
Vesty man roared, Vesty man thundered. You don't stand a chance of a cinder in snow. Vincent, if we fall, others arising.
From little things, big things grow. From little things, big things grow.
Absolutely fabulous song chosen by Dr. John Boffa, our guest for the year that made me, Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody there with From Little Things, Big Things Grow.